And welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, September 22nd. I'm Dagna, and I'll be your reader for this hour. We'll begin with the mini editorial, which today is written by Frank Gruber of Sioux City. And Frank writes, "It's such a pleasure to drive three open lanes at 65 miles an hour on the local stretch of Interstate 29. Well done." Again, this was written by Frank Gruber of Sioux City. And the headline for our first story is Ready to Move In. Habitat House will definitely be a home for the Keita Hill family. And this is Sioux City. The Saturday dedication of her new home as the latest project of Siouxland Habitat for Humanity was a pleasing event for Keita Hill, but she was already thinking ahead to Friday when she moves in, plus the months beyond. "Cannot wait. It is empty now, but Friday it will be a home," Hill said. "I love the deck. It is big. I can see myself in a swinging with coffee or hot cocoa." More than 20 people turned up at this ceremony in the 1800 block of Harkin Place on the west side, including friend and Seaboard Triumph plant co-worker Aaron Ramirez of Sioux City. Ramirez had read Hill's application essay to be considered for a Habitat home. "She came from a really hard spot," Ramirez said. "Trying to get by, to pay her bills. She persisted. She found a way. I believe you get what you give. She gives a lot." Habitat homes are generally modest, small compared to the norm of new homes, and often without finished basements, as is the case for Hill's unit. She's thinking of making it into a family room at some point. Habitat families do not get the homes for free, but they are built at a much lower cost than other houses since much of the labor is donated. In order to get the home, families must put in several hundred hours of sweat equity, which is viewed as a down payment. Hill noted she did not work on her own home, but did paint and perform other duties for Habitat homes being built elsewhere. The Siouxland Habitat is an affiliate of Habitat for Humanity International, a Christian housing ministry. Home dedications are not only a milestone for the soon-to-be homeowner, known as partner families, but a celebration of all the volunteers and donors who help make the dream of safe, affordable home ownership a reality, Siouxland Habitat for Humanity Executive Director Anna Holmes said. Back in the 2000, the city's Riverside area was the spot where a lot of Habitat homes went up. Hill's is the third in the Harkin Place cul-de-sac. "It seems like a nice neighborhood," Hill said, with a positive impression recently from seeing young children out playing, who could be playmates for the two children in her family. Son, Darius Rasmussen, 11, and nephew, Dalen Kemp, 10. "We're going to have great memories. The whole house, it is so beautiful," Kemp said. The home is roughly 1,400 square feet, with three bedrooms, a sizable bathroom, a kitchen, and expansive living room. Showing a bedroom while going barefoot, Hill said, "This carpet feels so good, smells so good." This will be the first time in her life that Hill, 26, who has lived in Sioux City for 12 years after leaving Des Moines, will not be living in a rental. "I thought it was impossible. I never thought I could afford a house that would be brand new," she said. Hill said that she doesn't like to be the center of attention, but took the dedication in stride in part because so much warmth came her way. One woman, leaving the event after half an hour, approached Hill, locked eyes, and said, "You have a wonderful house." Our next story is from this city council meeting held last night. And the headline is, "Sioux City Council passes measure strongly encouraging use of face coverings." 1 week ago, people presented a petition with more than 300 signatures urging the Sioux City Council to strongly recommend use of masks due to the spread of the novel coronavirus in the city. And on Monday, council members unanimously took that action. Several of the five council members noted that even an encouragement rather than a strict requirement to wear masks would be unpopular with a segment of the city's residents. Noting the question of whether or not to wear masks during the pandemic has become a culture war and also has political overtones. "No question, we will get hate mail because the community is so divided," said Mayor Bob Scott. Councilman Dan Moore said a key reason to strongly recommend the mask wearing is because the positivity rate of the virus has more than doubled beyond the 6% range 6 weeks ago in early August. "We are in trouble with the positivity rate," Moore said. Over the last 3 days, more than 200 positive cases have been reported in Woodbury County, including 100 alone on Saturday. Woodbury County is currently the 10th highest county in positivity rates in Iowa, at 15.2%, while 8 of the top 10 in the state are in the northwest Iowa. The mask issue was a late addition to the weekly council meeting, and it was presented as a resolution. It said the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends wearing masks to slow the spread of the virus. At the meeting, Siouxland District Health Department Director Kevin Green said people are getting COVID fatigue, while some do not see the efficiency of masks or believe the number of cases are overstated. Councilman Alex Waters related the story of a friend who was upset with the city in late spring, announcing that swimming pools would stay closed in 2020, a decision that was later converted to them opening, although with reduced capacity numbers. Waters said the woman was emphatic that such precautionary measures were unnecessary. "She died on Saturday due to COVID. She just had her first grandchild," Waters said. He added, "This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. It is a public health issue." The city for weeks has encouraged masks in city-owned buildings. However, Jeremy Pigg, who presented the petition on September 14th, said the signers want a broader city requirement for wearing masks in public places and stores, or at least that the council strongly recommend that. The council members, since July, have said they don't have legal authority to require masks, per Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, saying local officials need the governor's approval to implement such rules. However, since that time, several other large cities in Iowa have passed mask mandates, including Ames, Cedar Falls, Cedar Rapids, Decorah, Des Moines, Dubuque, Iowa City, Mount Vernon, Muscatine, and Waterloo. The Sioux City Council members have said they don't want to go to that extent. City Manager Bob Padmore said Police Chief Rex Mueller said Monday that officers who see people without masks will hand out some to be worn. Also in the meeting, it was said that Cindy White, who had been involved in the petition drive, would donate thousands of masks to the city. The resolution does not apply only to people wearing masks, but also businesses are encouraged to do their part by implementing safety protocols so that customers feel safe. Our next headline is ex-wastewater treatment plant superintendent charged with manipulating water samples, Sioux City. The former superintendent of Sioux City's wastewater treatment plant has been charged with manipulating water sample test results to make it appear that discharges from the plant into the Missouri River met federal requirements. Jay Nede is charged with conspiracy and falsifying or providing inaccurate information from 2012 through June 2015. He is scheduled to enter a plea October 6th in U.S. District Court in Sioux City. His attorney, John Greer of Spencer, filed notice Friday that Nede intends to plead guilty. Greer did not immediately return a message left for him on Monday. Nede is the second former plant official to be charged with manipulating chlorine levels to make it appear the city was meeting federal E. coli standards when wastewater samples were tested. Patrick Schwartz, who was a shift supervisor, pled guilty in January 2019 to the same two charges Nede faces. Schwartz is scheduled to be sentenced in November. Schwartz's appeal and Nede's expected guilty plea are not indictments of the city's operation of the plant, a Des Moines lawyer representing the city said Monday. Guy Cook said Nede and Schwartz acted on their own and were not directed by city department heads to doctor the water testing procedures. They were outliers. It was not a policy outlined by the city, Cook said. No other individuals have been charged, though an information document filed last week by the U.S. Attorney's Office said other plant operators, some who were known to prosecutors and others who were unknown, were involved in a process in which they were instructed by Nede and Schwarte to raise chlorine levels added to wastewater on days that E. coli samples were taken. The elevated chlorine level would produce test samples showing plant discharges met federal limits for levels of fecal coliform and E. coli. Once the samples were taken, chlorine added to the city's wastewater was reduced to minimal levels, unlikely to disinfect discharged water enough to meet these limits. The fraudulent procedures violated and concealed violation of the city's National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits and the Federal Clean Water Act, and deceived the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, which administers the city permits, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Attorney's Office alleges. The city's wastewater treatment practices drew attention in April of 2015 when the DNR was tipped off that plant supervisors were manipulating chemical levels used to treat sewage, resulting in legally permitted discharges into the Missouri River containing high levels of E. coli bacteria and potentially endangering public health. Improper chlorine releases also can endanger fish and water organisms. The city dismissed Nede and Schwarte in June of 2015. Nede told state investigators the city saved at least $100,000 in 1 year when workers administered the smaller levels of chlorine. He and Schwarte both agreed to surrender their state wastewater licenses when they were fired. The Federal Bureau of Investigation in December 2016 served a warrant on city offices and collected computer data. Cook said the city continues to work with the government, and city officials have said that new oversights and procedures have been implemented to prevent a repeat of the past illegal activities. The city has cooperated fully with the government and has worked to remedy the situation. That was done long ago, Cook said. The EPA referred questions about the investigation to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Office spokesman Tony Morfitt said he could not comment on ongoing investigations. In June 2016, the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission referred the DNR's case against the city to the Iowa Attorney General's office for consideration of civil penalties in excess of $10,000. The Attorney General's office also could file criminal charges. The state has stayed its case while the federal investigation proceeds. Built in 1961, Sioux City's wastewater treatment plant, located at 3100 South Lewis Boulevard, near the intersection of Interstate 29 and U.S. Highway 20, accepts industrial, commercial, and residential wastewater from Sioux City. The city also accepts wastewater from Sergeant Bluff, South Sioux City, North Sioux City, and Dakota Dunes. Once treated, the water is discharged into the Missouri River in accordance with state and federal regulations, including the Clean Water Act. Our next story headline is SBL Switching Learning Plan Due to Virus Quarantining. Sergeant Bluff. With novel coronavirus cases rising in Woodbury County, a switch in the method of learning at Sergeant Bluff Luton School District will take place Thursday for the high school and middle school levels. In a Monday letter to SBL parents, district officials wrote, "Due to the positive cases of COVID-19 in the middle school and high school and the large number of students that have had to quarantine due to possible exposure, the SBL school board voted to have the middle school and high school implement our hybrid learning plan beginning Thursday, September 24th to Friday, October 9th. The school board will meet on October 6th to mull whether to continue the hybrid model or move back to face-to-face instruction. A key statistical measure local and state officials are watching is the 14-day average of positive tests in each of Iowa's 99 counties. The Woodbury County ratio was 14.9% on Saturday and rose to 15.2% over the last 2 days. The 15% mark was established by the Iowa Department of Education as the point of which school districts can ask to move entire school buildings from in-person to online learning. In recent days, the top positivity rates in Iowa have been in northwest Iowa counties. Sioux County maintained its position in the top spot on Monday, when the 14-day positivity rate was 30.2%. As of Monday, the top six counties' positivity rates were in northwest Iowa, where Crawford, Iowa, with Crawford, Lyon, Osceola, Plymouth, Sac County ranking behind Sioux County. Ida County ranked 8th and Woodbury County ranked 10th. In Sergeant Bluff Luton, students in households with the last name beginning with A through K will be in school Monday and Thursday, while those with the last name beginning with L to Z will be in school Tuesday and Friday. Some students may be required to attend additional days based on individual needs. On Wednesday, schools will be open for 7 hours for students who have scheduled appointments for the additional support, such as individual help and small group instruction. Teachers will support remote and online learning, the letter said. Our next story headline is Woodbury County moves past 5,000 positive cases of coronavirus. The number of positive cases of the novel coronavirus in Woodbury County moved past the 5,000 mark on Monday. The Siouxland District Health Department reported there have been 58 cases added to the total case count in the last 24 hours. In the aggregate total since coronavirus cases were first detected in Woodbury County in March, there have been 5,017 cases as of Monday evening, and the numbers are rising in substantial fashion since mid-September. Over the last 3 days, more than 200 positive cases have been reported, including 100 alone on Saturday, and more than 300 cases over the last 5 days, where 87 cases from Thursday are factored in. Woodbury County continues to see a significant increase in COVID-19 cases recently. It is extremely important that everyone do their part to prevent the spread by staying home when sick, even if only mildly ill, or if you have had close contact with a COVID-19 case. Physical distancing, wearing masks in public, and washing hands frequently, the district health release said. The number of COVID-19 deaths in Woodbury County is 61. Also in the metro area on Monday, Dakota County Health Department reported 34 coronavirus cases, taking that total to 2,154. In recent days, the top positivity rates in Iowa have been in northwest Iowa counties. Sioux County maintained its position in the top spot on Monday when the 14-day positivity rate was at 30.2%. That Sioux County number is up by nearly 6% from 6 days ago when it was 24.2%. As of Monday, the top six counties' positivity rates were in northwest Iowa, with Crawford, Lyon, Osceola, Plymouth, and Sac counties ranking behind Sioux County. Ida County ranked 8th and Woodbury County ranked 10th. The headline for our next story is Sioux City man formally charged with murder and fatal stabbing. Sioux City. Formal charges of first-degree murder and attempted murder have been filed against a Sioux City man accused of fatally stabbing another man during a dispute. Assistant Woodbury County Drew Bockenstead filed a trial information containing those charges, plus willful injury causing serious injury against Michael Landrum Friday in Woodbury County District Court. An arraignment is scheduled for October 5th. Landrum, 54, remains in the Woodbury County Jail on a $500,000 bond. Landrum is charged with stabbing Salahin Adem on September 11th at 2103 Nebraska Street. He is also accused of stabbing Natasha Drapeau, who was hospitalized with serious injuries after the incident. Friday's filing contains no new information in the case, saying only that Landrum acted with malice aforethought to willfully, deliberately, and with premeditation kill Adem, 37, of Sioux City. The trial information also said Landrum intended to cause the death of Drapeau, 43. According to court documents, Landrum had been at a party with the two at Drapeau's apartment. After leaving, he returned to look for his missing cell phone and became upset with Adem and Drapeau, accusing them of taking it. Landrum left the apartment again and returned at 12:55 a.m., pounded on the door, and when Drapeau answered it, Landrum stabbed her multiple times with a steak-style knife. When Adem came to her assistance, Landrum stabbed him multiple times, court documents said. Police found Landrum walking in the 2400 block of Nebraska Street shortly after the incident and arrested him without incident. Police said they believed drugs and alcohol were involved in the incident. They have not said whether the knife has been recovered. If found guilty of first-degree murder, Landrum would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Attempted murder carries a prison sentence of 25 years, and willful injury is punishable by a 10-year prison system. Our next story, teen killed in Plymouth County collision, Hinton. A 19-year-old man died from injuries sustained in a two-vehicle collision Sunday at rural intersection west of Hinton. Jared Chu was pronounced dead at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center after being transported from the scene at the intersection of Plymouth County Roads C-60 and K-22. According to the Iowa State Patrol, Chu was a passenger in a Nissan Versa driven by Madison Lucier, 18, of Sioux City. An accident report said that Lucier was westbound on C-60 at 2:18 p.m. and did not stop at a stop sign, entering the path of a northbound Ford F-150 pickup driven by Adrian Topete Curio, 23, of Haywarden, who was passing another vehicle on K-22. Topete Curio struck Lazier's car on the driver's side, and both vehicles left the road and rolled. Chu was not wearing a seatbelt and was ejected from the Lucier vehicle. Lucier and a 17-year-old passenger, both of whom were wearing seatbelts, also were transported to the hospitals in Sioux City. Topiet Curio and a 17-year-old passenger in his pickup also were taken to a Sioux City hospital. Both were wearing seatbelts. The collision remains under investigation. And our next story is man sought by fugitive task force arrested. Sioux City. A man sought by the U.S. Marshal Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force has been arrested and jailed on a pending federal drug charge. Derek Wilkins, 35, was arrested early Sunday morning. Sioux City police officers arrested him after he was identified during a routine patrol operation on Sioux City's west side, according to the U.S. Marshal Service. He was booked into the Woodbury County Jail on a federal charge of conspiracy to distribute meth. We'll now move to the opinion page, and we do have some letters to the editor today. Our first letter today is written by Mark Sturgeon of Lamar's, and the headline on this one is, "When did wearing a mask become so offensive?" I see a lot of Facebook posts about seeing people driving their own cars with a face mask on. They're either being ridiculed or, in some cases, people actually seem mad about it. I also see posts where people wearing masks in public are confronted by people telling them to take it off. Don't be a sheep. Quit being afraid. When did wearing a mask become so offensive? I wear my mask to keep others safe and hopefully myself. I understand some people say, my body, my choice, you can't make me wear a mask. Let's start there. Okay, fine. If you were left alone and able to exercise your choice to not wear a mask, how does my wearing mask hurt you? I mean, really, how does anything I do in my car that doesn't put you at risk hurt you? How does my wearing a mask in a store hurt you? I feel like this is no longer about individual freedoms and more about taking sides. When did people start taking a stance against science? I wish people would do their own thing, but within the rules of a civil society, if a store says wear a mask, wear a mask. Don't like it? Shop somewhere else. If a store doesn't require masks, hey, knock yourself out. But if I'm wearing a mask, anywhere, anytime, go ahead and smirk. Think to yourself what a sheep in your mind, but keep it to yourself. Again, this letter was written by Mark Sturgeon of Lamar's. Our next letter is written by Fern Rockland of Sioux City and headlined Support Hansen for Iowa House. It is my pleasure to recommend and support Steve Hansen for Iowa House District 14. Both Steve and I graduated from Morningside College and we knew each other as students during the late 1970s. We both have been Sioux City citizens for over 40 years. Steve served as a loyal Democrat in the legislature from 1986 to 2002 with skill and devotion. He has always been courteous and engaging in conversations. In 2002, as museum director, he helped move the museum from Pierce Mansion to downtown Sioux City. He is someone who has worked with and knows about the history and culture of Sioux City. When I have family or friends visit me, I take them to the museum and they love it. Because of his experience in dealing with the public, he has respect and support from our citizens. He is passionate about Sioux City, education, healthcare, clean water, and job creation. I confidently support and recommend Steve Hansen for Iowa House District 14. And this was written by Fern Rockland of Sioux City. Our next letter was written by Jake Jungers of Sioux City, and it's headlined, Trump Should Make Court Decision Efficiently and Promptly. With the passing of the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it is the sole duty of the President of the United States to nominate someone who is immensely qualified to serve and fulfill that now vacant role. The timing will always be politicized by the opposing party. The decision is and will be President Donald J. Trump's to make, and it is imperative that he makes that decision efficiently and promptly so that the American people have someone in such a role to represent them. This is the natural course of life, and so is choosing the replacement of said vacancy. The Supreme Court of the United States must remain strong. Again, this was written by Jake Jungers of Sioux City. Our next letter is written by Carl Hardy of Sioux City, and it's headlined Disgusted. I am 72 years old, and over my many years of election rhetoric, I think 2020 has topped it off for negative ads and campaigning from both sides. Well, you know that the presidential election is going to contain a lot of stupid comments and negative ads. I am disgusted by the negative ads and comments by Iowa U.S. Senate candidates Joni Ernst and Teresa Greenfield. I am a Republican due to my strong stance on pro-life issues, and I could never vote for Teresa Greenfield because of her strong pro-choice stance. But I still want to hear answers from both candidates to the question, what are you going to do to make my life and the lives of my fellow citizens better? I have heard very little of this. Come on, Joni and Teresa, let us know where you stand. And also, Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden need to do the same. And this was written by Carl Hardy of Sioux City. And our last letter today is written by John Thomas of Vermilion, South Dakota, in the headline, Is Our Democracy on the Decline? Historically, authoritative forms of government have predominated. Dictators, kings, top-down rule rather than bottom-up. But power corrupts, so dictatorships evolve around the leader surrounding himself with loyal supporters, eliminating rivals, and keeping the masses at bay. Criticism of the king lands you in jail or worse. In comparison to dictatorships, democracies have been in the minority. Our democracy depends on freedom of expression, freedom of association, respect of others, and rule of law. Faith in our various institutions, an informed public, a free press, knowing truth from falsehood, faith in the electoral process, three co-equal branches of government, checks and balances, a strong two-party system with compromise essential for progress to occur. All of these seem to be under threat. We are either right or left. Both political parties have lost the ability to compromise and spend most of their efforts thwarting the other side. Each side has its own version of the truth. Conspiracy theories flourish. Other nations have watched our flailing and have become disenchanted. Democracy worldwide is on the decline. Is ours? How do we get out of this dilemma? How do we reestablish our democracy as a workable system? How do we learn to listen to each other rather than shout at each other, to compromise? When Benjamin Franklin was asked what kind of government our founding fathers had established, he responded, "A republic, if you can keep it." I hope we can. Again, this was written by John Thomas of Vermilion, South Dakota. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, September 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Our first one is Galen B. Jackson of Allen, Nebraska, passed away Saturday, September 19th at Regency Square Care Center in South Sioux City. Services will be 2 p.m. Wednesday at Allen United Methodist Church and will be live streamed. Arrangements are under the direction of Hesman Funeral Home in Wayne, Nebraska. Galen B. Jackson was born on October 16, 1927, on a farm west of Allen to Ben and Inez Emery Jackson. He attended country school through the eighth grade and graduated from Allen High School with honors in 1944. Galen married his high school sweetheart, Carol Geiger, on March 1, 1947, at First Lutheran Church in Allen. He began farming with horses and milking cows on the family farm west of Allen. The loves of his life include his family, and he was proud of every one of them, animals, especially horses, farming, fishing, camping, and playing 500 and some R set cards. Another hobby of his was reading. In fact, he probably read every Louis L'Amour book, some of them more than once. The inscription on his retirement watch was Kids, Cows, and Corn. Galen and Carol traveled to all 50 states, Canada, and Mexico. Over the years, Galen served on various boards and committees in the Allen community and was an 80-year member of the Allen United Methodist Church. Memorials may be directed to the family for later designation. James Jim Michael Mackey, 73, of Lamar's, passed away Thursday, September 17th at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. Visitation with the family present will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at Lamar's Church of Christ. Social distancing and wearing a mask are required. Interment will be at 10 a.m. Friday in Omaha National Cemetery, 14250 Schramm Road in Omaha. Arrangements are under the direction of Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamar's. Expression of sympathy can be extended to the family through www.rexwinklefh.com. James Michael Mackey was born on October 8, 1946 in Akron, Iowa, the son of Francis and Francis Scott Mackey. He attended school in Akron and graduated from Akron High School in 1964. Following graduation, he began his more than 20-year career with the United States military. He retired from military service in 2006. He was united in marriage to Randy L. Moore on January 14, 1967 in Akron and lived in Northwest Iowa most of their lives. In addition to working full-time for the Guard, he also worked for the Wells Dairy, Do It Best Hardware in Sioux City, and most recently part-time at Hardware Hank in Lamar's. Jim was a member of the Lamar's Church of Christ, where he served as an elder for many years. He was also a member of the American Legion. Memorials can be made in Jim's name to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society at http://donate.ils.org. Robert Bob Bonchance, Sheldon, Iowa, formerly of Melvin, Iowa, 85, died Monday, August 31st. Memorial service will be September 26th at 10 a.m. at the Sanborn Funeral Home in Sanborn. Burial will be at the Roseland Cemetery. John Henry Schutt, Jr., Waynesville, Missouri, formerly of Sioux City, 92, died Friday, September 18th. Family graveside service will be at the Missouri Veterans Cemetery in Waynesville. Memorial Chapels and Crematory of Waynesville is in charge of arrangements. Betty Taylor, Hartley, Iowa, 85, died Sunday, May 10th. Celebration of life will be September 25th at 2 p.m. at the Hartley Community Center. Family graveside service will be May 14th at the Pleasant View Cemetery. Visitation will be September 25th from 1 to 2 p.m. at the Community Center, Hartley Funeral Home in charge of arrangements. Justin Timothy Montagne, Vermilion, South Dakota, 27, died Sunday, September 20th. Service will be September 24th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Jefferson, South Dakota. Burial will be at the St. Peter's Catholic Church at the Catholic Cemetery. Visitation will be September 23rd from 6 to 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements by the Cobra Funeral Home of Vermilion. And that concludes the obituaries. We'll move on to other local stories. Siouxland man sought by fugitive task force. The U.S. Marshals Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the public assistance in locating the following person. James White, 30. He is 5'9" tall and weighs 180 pounds. White is wanted by the Woodbury County Sheriff's Office for failing to appear for court after being charged with possession with intent to deliver meth. He has tattoos on his right chest and right calf. Anyone with information can call the Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force at 712-252-0211 or email siouxlands.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. And this next story is from Nebraska. Man charged in protester's death dies by suicide. A white business owner charged with manslaughter for fatally shooting a black man during protests in Nebraska has died by suicide days after his indictment, his attorney said Sunday. Jacob Gardner of Omaha was found dead Sunday outside a medical clinic in Hillsboro, Oregon, the Hillsboro Police Department said in a news release. His attorney, Stu Dornan, said in a news conference Sunday evening that Gardner's death was a suicide. Unfortunately, there are two men who have died in a terrible tragedy, Dornan said. It is a terrible tragedy for the Omaha community. It's a terrible tragedy for James Scurlock and his family, and it's a terrible tragedy for the Gardner family. A grand jury on Tuesday charged Gardner, 38, with manslaughter in the death of James Scurlock, the black man authorities say Gardner shot May 30th, during a protest against police brutality and racial injustice outside Gardner's bar in Omaha. Gardner was also charged with attempted assault, making terroristic threats, and using a gun to commit a felony. Gardner has said the shooting was done in self-defense. Douglas County Attorney Don Klein initially decided not to charge Gardner, saying he acted in self-defense. After intense criticism, a grand jury was called to examine the case, resulting in charges being filed against Gardner. Dornan said Gardner, who had gone to California after the shooting, was really shook up after the grand jury's indictment. The grand jury indictment was a shock to him, and it was a shock to us, Dornan said. Attorney Tom Monahan, who also spoke during Sunday's news conference, said the community of Omaha had convicted Mr. Gardner on social media. Special Prosecutor Frederick Franklin has said the grand jury reviewed additional evidence that Klein didn't have, including texts from Gardner's phone, messages on his Facebook profile, and his interactions with bystanders before coming into contact with Spurlock. Franklin declined to provide specifics of what the new evidence shows, except to say it undermines the notion of self-defense. An arrest warrant was approved for Gardner on Friday. He was scheduled to return to Omaha on Sunday to face the charges against him. We have a few sports stories for the local area, and our first one is headlined, West Lyon moves to number one in 2A. There are now two teams ranked number one in Siouxland. After beating then-ranked number 9 Unity Christian this past week, West Lyon moved from number 3 in Class 2A to the top-ranked team in the class. The Wildcats, who received the 1A title last season, received 3 of the 13 first-place votes and have 115 points, 2 points more than Williamsburg, which has 3 first-place votes and have 113 points. PCM has 5 first place votes and are third with 111 points. Central Lyon, George Little Rock, in fourth and received the other 2 first place votes. The Lyons have 97 points and were fourth last week. They are 1 spot ahead of their week 5 opponent, Sioux Center. The Warriors have 67 points and moved up to a spot to 6. Spirit Lake is receiving votes with 6 points, 9 points behind number 10 Esterville, Lincoln Central. Unity Christian fell out of the rankings, but is receiving votes with 4 points. OABCIG is still the top team in Class 1A, receiving 11 of 13 first place votes. The Falcons, who are 4-0, have 120 points ahead of South Central Calhoun, who received the other 2 votes with 108 points. West Sioux, which is 3-1, moved from the first team receiving votes into the number 10 spot in 1A this week. The Falcons have 23 points. Western Christian, who the Falcons beat on Friday, are receiving votes and had 3 points. In Class 3A, even though Sergeant Bluff Luton beat Lamar's, the Warriors moved from number 8 to number 9, getting passed by Decorah. The Warriors have 25 points to Decorah's 35. Spencer received a vote this week. Cedar Rapids Xavier is the top team in 3A. Remsen St. Mary's moved up a spot in the 8-man rankings. The Hawks, who are 4-0, received 2 of the 13-place votes, are ranked number 3 with a 4-0 record and 94 points. Audubon, which is receiving 3 first-place votes, moved into the top spot with 115 points. Newell Fonda stayed at number 7 in the 8-man rankings with 63 points, just behind Montezuma and Fremont Mills, both of which are tied for 5th. In Class A, Woodbury Central is the first team receiving votes with 14 points. MFL Mar Mac is the number 10 team with 18 points. Lawton Bronson is also receiving votes and has 2 points, and Ridgeview also has 2 points. Grundy Center is the top team in Class A. Southeast Polk is the top team in Class 4A. And our next story is about college golf, with the headline, Mustang Men, Women Lead Northwest Iowa National, Lamar's. Leah Badosa and the Morningside Women's Golf Team had one of the best days in the program's history on Monday at the Northwest Iowa National Invitational at Willow Creek Golf Club. Both the Morningside Women's and Men's Golf Teams were in first place at the National Invite. Badosa, a junior, set the school record for the lowest 18-hole score with a 66 in the first round. 2 rounds were played on Monday. Badosa then shot a 68 in her second round and has a commanding lead going into Tuesday's final day. Badosa has a 2-round score of 10 under par, 134, and leads Wayland Baptist Laura Kelmova and Mustang teammate Samantha Knight by 7 strokes. Knight is tied for 2nd with a 141. She shot a 70 in the first round and a 71 in the second round as she is 3 under par. Those two were part of a solid showing for the Morningside women, which shot a 285 in the first round, which sets a new team record. The Mustangs followed that with a 289 in round 2 for a 574 as Morningside leads after the first day by 17 strokes over Texas Wesleyan University. Morningside as a team is 1 stroke under par. Morningside's Sophie Castellan shot a 5 over par, 149, is tied for 6th. Maria Zorella shot a 7 over par, 151, and is tied for 8th. Maria Nava is tied for 14th place after shooting a 9 over par, 153. Lauren Carr is in 27th with a 165. Briarcliff is in 6th place as the charges were consistent over the 2 rounds. Briarcliff shot a 327 in the first round and a 328 in the second for a 655. Frankie Valencia is in the top 20 after the first day as she shot a 76 in the first round and a 77 in the second for a 9 over par 153 to tie for 14th place. Emily Hartsey and Molly Diekman are both tied for 29th with a 167 and Ann Hedlund is tied for 31st with a 168. Grace Johansson is tied for 33rd with a 172, and Abigail Miller is 37th with a 175. Morningside is leading the men's standings. The Mustangs shot a 290 in the first round and followed with a 292 in the second round. As a team, the Mustangs shot 10 over par for 582. Morningside leads Northwestern. I'll start that paragraph again. Morningside leads Northwestern by 2 strokes as the Red Raiders shot a 292 for both rounds. Briarcliff is 6th with a 610 and Dort is 11th with a 629. While Northwestern is in 2nd place, the Red Raiders have the top individual. Ezra Meyer leads the whole pass with a 2 under par 141. He shot a 71 in the first round and shaved a stroke off his score in the second round. Morningside is led by Sam Story, who shot an even par with a 143 and is in 3rd place, only 2 strokes behind Meyer. Johnny Douglas is tied for sixth place with a 3 over par 146. After shooting a 76, Douglas carded a 1 under par 70 to get back in the mix. Jackson Stitzman is tied at 6th with Douglas. Stitzman shot a 69 in the first round and was in the lead, but shot a 77 in the second. Corey Matthey is tied for 9th with 4 over par. He shot a 72 in the first round and 75 in the second. Paul Henry Hine is 15th with 149. He shot a 79 in the first round, but shaved 9 strokes off his score in the second round. Tanner Haberle is tied for 17th with a 151. After Meyer, the Red Raiders had 2 more golfers in the top 10. Isaac Knock is 2 over par with a 145 and is in a tie for 4th. He shot a 71 in the first round and followed with a 74. Cobley Newberg is tied for 9th with a 4 over par 147 as he shot a 75 in the first round, followed by a 72. Kyle Christie is tied for 12th with 158. After a 76 in the first round, he followed with a 72 in the second. Brock Murphy is tied for 17th with a 151. We'll follow that with a golf story for high school. And the headline is Bruns Wins Conference Meet, Del Rapids, South Dakota. Paul Bruns added a DAK Conference Golf Medal to his case after the Dakota Valley Senior won the conference championship on Monday at Rocky Run Golf Course. Bruns shot a 2 over par 73 to claim the conference medalist honors by 2 strokes over West Central's Trey Evan. Dakota Valley finished in 8th place as a team as the conference meet. T won the conference title by 13 strokes over Lennox. Isaac Bruns added an 89 for Dakota Valley. Logan Collette had a 99, and Ben Niemeyer and Tyler Cornelson each shot 100. Dylan Lucan added a 102. And then our next story is BVU has athletics postponed until 2021. Storm Lake. Buena Vista University, in accordance with members of the American Rivers Conference, will postpone the start of winter sports seasons until January 1, 2021. This decision, a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, will result in a later regular season start for women's basketball, men's basketball, and wrestling. The ARC announced the whole league will postpone the start of the winter sports season until January 1, 2021. The decision allows coaches and administrators to work with student athletes at BVU and other schools to further focus on ensuring return to competition protocols are in place before safely resuming competition. BVU will still have the autonomy to conduct practices for these sports prior to January 1st in accordance with NCAA rules. The practice start date for women's basketball, men's basketball, and wrestling is October 1st, and the 114-day season remains in place. Indoor track and field may practice immediately, as may dance and cheer teams. Competition schedules will be developed based on NCAA decisions regarding winter championships, which will be rendered at a later date. The American Rivers Conference in August postponed the traditional fall seasons of football, men's soccer, women's soccer, and volleyball, a response to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19. The seasons for those contact sports are likely to begin at some point during the second semester, with an announcement concerning schedules for those sports to come from the American Rivers Conference in the approaching days. Mustangs Bessie earns honor, Sioux City. Junior defensive back Drew Bessie represented Morningside football program on the September 14th through the 20th Great Plains Athletic Conference Defensive Player of the Week awards. Bessie earned Defensive Player of the Week accolades in a 42-7 league road win at Midland University September 19th. He registered a personal single game high 10 tackles and recorded a key interception that foiled a Warriors scoring march in the first half and allowed head coach Steve Ryan's squad to build a 21-point advantage. BCU names Watts associate coach. Sioux City. Briarcliff University wrestling head coach Joe Privateer announced that Charger assistant Donico Watts has been elevated to the title of associate head coach. Watts has been an assistant for the Chargers since 2013. In his time at BC, The Chargers have won a GPAC team title, and 27 athletes have made the trip to the NIA National Wrestling Tournament, with four earning All-American honors. USHL holds dispersal draft. With Cedar Rapids and Madison unable to participate in the 2020-2021 season, the USHL held a dispersal draft on Monday. The Sioux City Musketeers ended up with four players through the dispersal draft: Doug Grimes and Justin Hyrecorn, both of Cedar Rapids, and DJ Hart and Asa Kinnear, both of Madison, were picked up by Sioux City. This is for one season, as the rights for both players go back to Cedar Rapids and Madison, which plan to participate in the 2021-22 season. And our next story, the headline is Brannons lead Siouxland Christian to win. Sloan. The Brannons were the top runners at the Westwood Cross Country Invite on Monday, which led to the Siouxland Christian boys team to a first place finish. Lawton Bronson won the girls team title. Eric Brannon easily won the boys race as the senior crossed the line in 18:42.79, almost 40 seconds ahead of second place, which happened to be another Brannon. Sam Brannon finished in second place. He finished 2 seconds ahead of Ponca's Brody Taylor. A.J. Getch finished in 10th place for Siouxland Christian, and Jackson Harsman was 11th. The Eagles finished with 18 points to finish in first place ahead of West Monona, which had 29 points. Lawton Bronson's Theo Mosen was 4th, and West Monona's Trayton Harris was 5th. Ponca's Kayan Schramm followed, and West Monona's Jace Runyon was 7th. Homer runners finished in 8th and 9th, as Tim Harris finished 21:56.82 and Grant Lander finished 21:58.41. In the girls' race, Lawton Bronson's Jolie Mez crossed the line in first place. West Monona had the next two runners, as Mallory McCall finished 2nd and Jaylee Anderson 3rd. Lawton Bronson's Emily Chamberlain was 4th, and Westwood's Katie Moonchath was 5th. And that completes the sports stories. We'll have a short little one about what to know about online banking. As the COVID-19 pandemic leads banking customers to lean into online technology to manage their money, those trying online banking for the first time may find themselves with questions about how to handle things previously done in person or with paper documents. If you're stuck on how to handle some of the practical aspects of online banking, here are answers to a couple of the questions. Should I save monthly statements? Experian, one of the three major credit bureaus, recommends keeping bank statements for tax purposes to confirm your income or deductible expenses. If you do end up using your statements for your taxes, you may want to hang on to your statements for up to 7 years in case the IRS decides to audit you. Even if your bank keeps digital records of your statements, you may want to print or download your statements just in case. When should I shred the paper check from a mobile deposit? Major banks recommend that after you've made a mobile deposit, you write mobile deposit and the date of deposit on the front of the check. Keep the check until you've made sure the deposit has gone through, which may take several days, and that the bank doesn't need the original check for any reason. Once the check has cleared in your account, it's best to shred it. And how do I send money or pay bills through my mobile banking app? If you want to send money to friends or family, your bank may have you covered with Zelle Money Transfer Service. Zelle, which is integrated with many major banks and also available as a separate app, allows registered users to receive and send money from their bank accounts. You can also sign up for money transfer apps like Venmo or Cash App and link them to your bank account to send and receive money, as long as your sender or recipient has the same app. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, September 22nd. I'm Dagna. I have been your reader for the past hour. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers from Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwebar, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.